I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the serial entrepreneur Jack Dorsey. He's the co-founder of Twitter, a social networking media service launched in 2006. Twitter has over 500 million users internationally. The company gained global recognition when it facilitated the Iranian protests of the presidential election in 2009. Jack is also the co-founder of Square, a mobile payments company that allows any merchant to accept payments through a device that plugs into their smartphone's headphone jack. The company started by working with micro-merchants or small business owners who didn't traditionally have the ability to accept credit cards, but it has grown rapidly to include other services and larger businesses, such as Starbucks, as well. Jack is a former massage therapist. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with your personal life because I think it helps to inform the choices that you've made later on. You grew up in Missouri, in St. Louis, and you had a particularly close relationship with your parents, especially your mother. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, my parents have a very interesting story. My father, when he was 19 years old, started a pizza restaurant with his best friend, and they called it Two Nice Guys. The business started doing very, very well, and they needed to hire help, and they wanted to preserve their friendship and also the business. So they made one rule between the two best friends, which is they would not date the waitstaff. And the first person they hired was my mother. My father fell in love with my mother and went to his best friend and said, "I broke the rule. The business is yours." And I was born 10 months later. Hmm. So my parents have always had this edge of entrepreneurship. My mom later started a coffee store in St. Louis called Shenandoah Coffee. Mm-hmm. And my father has had a small business around medical devices for over 25 years. Mm-hmm. So I've learned a lot about starting small and starting one's own business from them.
Obviously, you observe them being very entrepreneurial. But what about emotionally? How was your relationship with them?
It was great. You know, they always pushed me to explore new things. And I had a very meandering, wandering path throughout my life. And that was always something that was loved and accepted. I think technology, especially Twitter, has really deepened our relationship.
Why is that?
Because when we first started Twitter, we got a lot of critique about it being used to talk about what one is having for breakfast, for instance. You know, to 99.9999% of the world, updates like that are useless. But my mother loves it. She loves knowing that I'm eating breakfast every day, and she loves knowing that I'm alive. And it's these little things in life, these small details, that really bind us. We always know what's going on in each other's lives.
It's ironic that you say Twitter's brought you closer because you focus on the mundane aspects of your day, because that's exactly what Twitter has been criticized for. Like, who cares about that? And it's actually just that which has been the most important in your usage of it, vis-a-vis your mom, at least.
I believe so. And also for public figures that we often put on pedestals. You know, one of the most compelling moments for me was watching on the campaign trail in 2008. President Barack Obama talking about what he had for breakfast or just little details of his day. And I think that adds so much context. It rehumanizes people.
Technology was an important part of your life, you know, even when you were 7, 8, 9 years old, and you had a particular interest in maps. Why were you drawn to maps so much, and how did technology tie in?
My parents always loved the city. I just loved the energy. I loved the dynamic range, how electric it felt. So in order to understand the city better, I developed this fascination with maps, maps of New York, maps of St. Louis. My parents bought a computer in 1984, Macintosh, when I was 8 years old, and I just fell in love with that technology as well, because you could see things move around, and it wasn't just a static map, but I could actually start programming them, and I could teach myself, and I did teach myself how to draw maps on the computer, and then to draw dots moving around the map, and then constrain them within streets, and then I had all these dots moving around this map, and I thought it was the most beautiful thing in the world, but the dots had no meaning whatsoever. So my parents had a police scanner. They had a CB radio. We lived right next to the highway, so I heard all this activity. And if you listen to an ambulance or a police car or a fire truck, they're always reporting where they are, what they're doing, and where they're going. So, and I could use that as input for my programs that I was writing to attribute meaning to one of those dots. And I could actually simulate its path throughout the city, which was amazing because suddenly I could see the city living and breathing, and I added more and more dimensions, taxis, black cars, couriers, and I eventually learned that this entire practice had a name and an industry, which was called dispatch. Mm. So I made it my life to go after and write dispatch software and find the biggest dispatch firm in the world, which happened to be here in New York City.
You were engrossed in programming from an early age. What were you like socially at school? What was your reputation?
I was more quiet than not. I went to all Catholic school for most of my life until university. I really loved drawing.
While you seem to have had a very nurturing, loving home environment, you had dreadlocks, you had blue hair, you listened to punk rock, you had this nose ring, you have a big tattoo on your forearm. Do you have any other tattoos?
I have a tattoo of a star on my ankle.
You have one on your ankle.
Yep.
Now, is this just emblematic of, you know, the typical turmoil of adolescence, or was there more going on?
Well, I like experimenting a lot, and I'm somewhat impulsive. So when I decide to do something, I pretty much go all in. So I had dreadlocks when I first moved to San Francisco, I listened to a lot of punk rock just because I liked the attitude. There was an attitude in punk rock which really mirrored hacker culture, which was you don't have to be perfect at performing. You don't have to be perfect at an instrument. You take a guitar and you get out there.
And it seems like that's what you've done with Square in a way. You had no background in financial services, but you said, you know what, let's just take my guitar and get out there.
Yeah, yeah. You drive more by principle of what do you want to see in the world.
Mm.
And you do whatever it takes to make sure that happens.
Incidentally, you refused to learn how to drive as well.
Yeah, I was a big fan of public transit because I thought it was core to cities.
The style that you carried, the dreadlocks and the nose ring, et cetera, are particularly striking given the way you look today. Short hair, very clean shaven, sort of, actually, not really.
Yeah.
And just very dapper. So you seem to have jumped into now this new style.
Well, I mean, we raised our first round at Twitter with a tattoo and a nose ring. It doesn't change people's perception of you that much. It was really about the merit of a video, and that's what I loved about it.
You now run and meditate and eat well. Have you always been mindful of your health and fitness?
When I was a kid, I developed this fascination with walking through my Aunt Eileen. She would walk all the time, and that was really my first form, although I didn't know what I was doing, of meditation, because that's where I really go to when I want to think about something or think through something or just get away. I take a walk.
Did you run today?
No, I did exercise. I do exercise every day.
What did you do?
Just simple stuff, jumping jacks, jump rope, sit-ups, and push-ups.
In your hotel room?
In my hotel room.
And you think you're alone. You're like, I'm the only one doing this. But actually...
No, I know I'm not alone.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jack Dorsey, co-founder of the social networking company Twitter and Square, the mobile payments company. Jack eats two hard-boiled eggs with soy sauce every morning. You left University of Missouri during college and moved to New York City. And this is after you hacked the system of a public company called DMS, Dispatch Management Service. And the CEO was impressed and said, come to New York. Mm-hmm. So you transferred to NYU and you ended up working for this company. What was that experience like?
Yeah, it was great. So I always wanted to work in dispatch. I always wanted to live in Manhattan. And I found the biggest dispatch firm in the world, which was DMS. I found that they had this hole in their web server, and I emailed them, here's how you fix it. And I was flown out, and within a week I had a job. And we decided to move to San Francisco. in 1999 and start a more web-focused dispatch company.
In addition, you also started together with Greg Kidd, the founder of the company, an e-commerce software company that offered same-day deliveries. And it struck me that this was very early days and really the nascent stages of e-commerce. And the company was called DNet, and it ultimately didn't work out. Do you think it was just timing?
I think it was timing. It was also we didn't really put the emphasis on engineering. We had very, very few engineers and a lot of salespeople, and it was just out of balance. Also, we built the company at the same time the entire bubble was about to burst. I learned a lot from that experience. That was the first company that I really pushed and built. I was a founder, but I wasn't running any of the company, and that's one of the things that I took away from it.
During this time, you know, moved to San Francisco, your first startup did not go well. You had random programming jobs. You built a dispatching service for the ferry service going to Alcatraz, among other systems. You became a massage therapist. You took sewing classes. This is all in the spirit of exploration. But was there any jitteriness of feeling like, okay, my motor's really turning, but I'm really not making palpable linear progress?
No, I never saw it that way. You know, programming is an art and a craft that you stay in your head a lot. You're not really working with your hands. Your hands are on the keyboard, but it's all mental. Every time I felt overwhelmed with that, I wanted to do something more with my hands. And I had all these kind of meandering paths to allow me to be more tangible. My first was botanical illustration, and I went back to programming, and then I started developing RSI, carpal tunnel, and I do have this tendency to want to learn something and go all into it. And,
as you said before.
as I said before, and my friend suggested that I get a massage, and I said, oh, I got a massage, and it actually helped me, and I said, why not just learn how to do this myself? So I took 1,000 hours of massage therapy and learned everything about the body. But then went back to programming because I always have this draw to create through that medium, and did the same thing with sewing and denim specifically, because I just love denim because it takes on the wear of someone's life. But eventually went back to programming.
By the way, my husband has this motto, nihil in moderado, which is nothing in moderation. You should like tattoo that on your other arm.
Or everything in moderation.
Perhaps.
Nothing is everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jack Dorsey, co-founder of Twitter and the financial services company Square. We'll hear more from Jack coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the internet entrepreneur Jack Dorsey. He's the founder of Twitter, the social media company that allows users to send messages using no more than 140 characters. He's also the founder of the mobile payments company Square. Other names considered for Square were seashells, an early currency people used to exchange goods, and squirrel, the idea being that people gather funds from others in the same way that squirrels gather acorns. In 2005, you got a more traditional job at a company called Odeo, which was a podcast directory company, which ultimately didn't do well because iTunes came out with their service. And through this turmoil, you developed Twitter, although the seeds for Twitter were kind of in your back pocket in 2000 when you initially had the idea for something that became Twitter. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what that germ was in 2000? Briefly?
Well, leading from dispatch, you know, I had this beautiful picture of the city, but I was missing the people, and I was a big fan of instant messenger as well, with especially around statuses. So I'm on a call, I'm in a meeting, I'm listening to this particular song. So the idea was to be able to take something small like that and to take it anywhere. And I had the first BlackBerry device, the RIM 850. And I coded up I programmed a little service that took an email from that device, and it would send it out to all my friends. And I was living in San Francisco at the time. I went to Golden Gate Park. There's a bison paddock with bison roaming around in Golden Gate Park in the middle of the city. And I went there and I said, I'm at the bison paddock in Golden Gate Park. And it was sent out to all my friends via email. And I quickly learned that, number one, no one cared, and number two, No one else had a BlackBerry device. It was an interesting idea, but it was ahead of its time a bit, and the technology just was not there.
The technology wasn't there until 2006.
So, in 2006, sure enough, I was introduced to SMS at Edodio, and SMS short messaging service, text messages, was just a beautiful technology. I fell in love with it. It had this great constraint of 160 characters. It worked on every single phone out there. The idea came back up. What if we just took text messaging and we enabled anyone to text a service and then it would go out to all the people that cared about it?
You mentioned that you like the constraint of 160 characters of texting. You've always seemed to have an appreciation for minimalism. Growing up, your mom said that when you moved into your new home, you chose the smallest room and you had two younger brothers.
I don't like having a lot of stuff. I don't like carrying around a lot. I like a lot of simplicity, and really just comes down to not having to carry much in the world. So I'm a person who, you know, when I find a watch, it's going to be the watch for the rest of my life. And when I find a bag, you know, I'll keep it for 15, 20 years.
Now, was your love of these 160 characters, you think, consistent with your minimalism? Or why did you love the 160?
I love the 160 because I do like constraint. If I give you a paintbrush and I tell you to go paint this huge canvas I have on the wall, it's somewhat intimidating and you're going to be very thoughtful and composed about it. If I give you that same paintbrush and I give you the back of a business card and tell you to make a mark, you'll make a mark. So there's something interesting about making the canvas size small and making it more approachable. And then it becomes more of the moment, becomes more expressive, and every mark, therefore, is beautiful and useful to someone. I was not someone who really enjoyed blogging because the format was just too long and unconstrained, whereas with 160 characters, which we then pulled down to 140 characters, there was a nice constraint, and I could be more of the moment, and there was more creativity because I had to fit it all in.
Why did you then pick 140 characters for Twitter? Was that arbitrary?
Well, there are two reasons. The 160 was purely practical in the sense that we wanted to work on every device out there. So a $5 cell phone in the middle of Kenya could also receive a message from anywhere in the world. And also that constraint inspires creativity concept. So we took 20 characters out for a username and for some syntax, and we arrived at 140 characters.
And Twitter, the name, the definition is inconsequential bursts of information.
Yes, and chirps from birds.
Right. Yeah. And some other names you flirted with, Jitter and Twitch.
Twitch.
Right.
They don't bring up the best imagery.
Mm. So at the time, you were working with Ev Williams and Biz Stone, who had worked at a company called Blogger, sold to Google. And you were made CEO. And prior to that, you were a contractor for mm-hmm. them. Why did they think that you should be CEO? You were very young. You had no leadership experience. By the way, I should mention Noah Glass was involved
yes.
as well.
So Noah was the co-founder of Odeo, and Ev was the CEO. And as soon as iTunes launched the directory, the company became directionless. So brought up the idea for Twitter, and we built it in 2 weeks. And the first tweet was actually inviting coworkers, which were inviting my coworkers from Odeo to join me. And you know, the reason that I became CEO is because I was leading the product and I was leading the direction, and it made sense. And we had about 7 people at that time.
And how are you feeling at the time? You know, you were programming, but you were also managing. Were you like, okay, like I'm owning this, I'm good at it?
It wasn't really something that I thought about. I thought about just building the product. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't something that you had to manage necessarily. I actually think managing is somewhat of a reactive word. It's something like I have to manage the situation versus coach
editing
or build.
Or editing.
Editing is another good one. So very particular about the words that we use in the companies, and I think that sets the tone for everything.
What were your ambitions for Twitter? How much of an impact did you think it would have?
Well, it's fairly selfish. I wanted to go back to that idea of maps, and I wanted to see the world. I wanted to see how the world was feeling. I wanted to see what it was doing.
Were you surprised when President Obama adopted it for his town halls and the Iranian protesters used it to the extent that the U.S. State Department asked you to keep the service running when you were going to do a maintenance, and Rupert Murdoch's using it? Talk to me about your level of surprise or...
Well, every day there's a new surprise and something that we find really, really delightful about how people are using it. So people tweet by tweet change how they think about it and how the world thinks about the service. And that, to me, shows something that's going to last, because it's like electricity. It's something that we don't really think about unless we're talking about it, unless it goes down. Otherwise, we plug in a microwave oven, we plug in an electric guitar, a keyboard, a seat warmer, whatever. But it's always there. It's always useful. And we can have all these different experiences based on how we perceive it and based on how we use it.
Ev Williams asked you to leave as CEO. Was that a surprise to you, or what was your reaction?
Well, we switched roles. So Ev really wanted to be CEO, and he was our chairman, and I became chairman, and he became CEO. So it was a different, certainly different perspective. It was surprising and also freeing at the same time.
You seem very measured and unflappable, but is that really, like, I'd love to just dig into your emotional state. Was it like, okay, well, that's disappointing, but blessing?
No, it was a hard departure. You know, it was something that I loved, that I'd been thinking about since I was a kid, and to not be as directly involved was certainly extremely, extremely challenging and devastating for me for quite some time. But you have to get over it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jack Dorsey, the co-founder of the social networking company Twitter, and Square, a mobile payments company that, among other attributes, offers a micro-merchant payment acceptance service that allows any business owner to accept payments from customers. Merchants are charged a flat 2.75% for each transaction, which is lower than the typical fee that payment processors have historically charged. The company offers Square Register, which turns mobile devices into a point-of-sale system, providing inventory management, customer tracking, and other business analytics. Square Wallet allows customers to buy products, such as Starbucks coffee, without having to use their actual credit card. You founded Square with a partner, Jim McKelvey, who is a glassblower, and he was your first boss in Missouri. You worked for him as one of your odd jobs, helping him with his back office maintenance, essentially. Yeah. How did you and Jim come to the idea of Square?
Jim is a glassblower. He kind of departed engineering. He was building companies before, and that's a company I worked for. And he really got into glassblowing, and he was doing it, and he was selling these glass faucets and pieces of glass, and he would sell them for $2,000 a piece. And one day, someone called him up and wanted to buy one, but he couldn't accept a credit card. He couldn't accept an Amex card, and he lost a sale because of it. 90% of this country, at least, is paying with plastic: debit cards, credit cards, prepaid cards. So if you don't accept plastic, you miss out on sales. People go elsewhere. So we just found it funny that one could not just download an app today and start accepting credit cards. And we decided to take a month and to figure out if we could build a system around it.
Now, you had been noodling on other ideas prior to choosing to move forward with Square. One other idea he had was to build an electric car company.
Yes, we were looking at everything. I actually wasn't looking at finance much at all, because I really have no basis for it. I don't understand it.
You launched at an auspicious time, ironically. It was in 2008, at the time of the crash. Can you describe that a little more?
Yeah, there were a lot of auspicious pointers to what we were doing. First, I was living across the street from the U.S. Mint in San Francisco.
Coincidentally.
Which is a very auspicious location to start a payments company, and it's purely coincidence. There's no better time to create something than in a depression or a recession, because people are resetting. They're a little bit more willing to take a look at new things.
Although, venture capitalists might not feel like it's a very favorable time. People are, keeping their wallets close. You know, people thought, oh, you're the Twitter guy. You know, this is random to do financial services. What do you think convinced them?
Showing them the product. So, the best thing was we built this system in a month and we could start accepting credit cards. And they said, wow. So, I did approach a lot of VCs and investors with this idea, and they did push back. You worked on quote unquote microblogging. You worked on something that people used to talk about what they had for breakfast. Why do you think you can move billions of dollars around in a financial market.
What role did the Golden Gate Bridge have in just, you know, being wallpaper, to helping to influence your motivation, if any?
Absolutely. We live in a very fortunate area in San Francisco, and we look to the Golden Gate Bridge all the time because it's not just the end product that is gorgeous and amazing and iconic. And a wonder, but also the way they built it. They built it in 1934. They gave themselves 5 years. They built it in 3 years. Only 1,300 people worked on the bridge. They did it with $33 million, which is about $1.2 billion in today's money. Mm. So epic scale. And it's a 1.7-mile span across one of the most tumultuous areas on the West Coast. And then there's earthquakes. It's the last place on the planet that you want to build a bridge. So, you know, at its very core, a bridge is utility. It gets people from point A to point B. And at its very core, Square and Twitter is a utility. It gets either communication from point A to point B or money from point A to point B. And they have a lot of parallels. And if it does that well, it disappears. But if people really notice it, it's something that is breathtaking and they appreciate it. So we want to build something that that is similar to that idea.
Along those lines, the Square's card reader was inducted into the Museum of Modern Art's archive in 2011.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Skeuomorphism?
Yes.
What is that?
Skeuomorphism is a practice and design to through digital interfaces to refer to real interfaces. I think there's a great balance of referencing something that we know as we go into something new, which is digital. And that's what we're trying to do at Square. A lot of our products reference real objects because it establishes trust. It's an opening. With Square Register, the thing actually looks like a paper pad and we have a page turn as you're ripping off a ticket. Square Wallet, there's references to cards. There's references to leather. Just hints at them. But that's really all it takes.
And they hint at them so that people don't feel as intimidated to try them and to adopt them.
Yeah, there's a warmth to things we know and to things we're used to.
I want to go back to the early days of Square. You saw a hole in the financial service market where micro merchants or small businesses weren't able to accept credit cards because the payments to credit card companies were just too onerous. What was Amex and MasterCard and Visa's response to your entering?
So there's 8 million entities, 8 million businesses that accept credit cards in the United States alone, but there's over 26 million small businesses who don't. So they saw it as a way to extend their network. At the end of the day, what they care about the most is removing cash and moving more to electronic payments. So they saw Square as a way to really advance that agenda.
Your first few merchants were Sightglass, which is this coffee shop in San Francisco you're an investor in, mm-hmm. as well as a florist. Mm-hmm. Who else were some of the earliest?
We had, Sightglass, which was just a coffee cart, a flower cart named Lilybell. And a flight instructor, actually, and that was it.
Starbucks was your first larger business, which has opened up a completely new array of partners for you. How did that happen? Did Howard Schultz approach you, or did you approach them? What's the story there?
Howard and Starbucks actually approached us, and they said, you know, we've been looking at a lot of payment companies, and we've been looking at really moving ahead in terms of how we're thinking about mobile payments specifically. We would love for you to come up to Seattle and tell us about Square. So we went up there, and we just had a great meeting.
You, in less than a year, built the hardware and the payment network and the risk systems and the customer service and the web services, and you coordinated all these systems all from scratch, basically.
Mm-hmm. All from scratch. We built Square and made it operational in under 9 months. And then Starbucks was very similar.
So what are some hiccups that you've had in the early days? Because it seems like things have been pretty seamless.
Some of the hiccups that we saw was, you know, it took us a lot longer than normal to actually get the credit card processing infrastructure out. We had to go through a lot of regulation. So we first launched Square as a cash-only register. And people knew about Square before that, and the promise was you could accept credit cards anywhere. So the people that were really cheering for us said, you know, what's going on? And it took us another 5 months to actually roll out the credit card processing.
What about, because you're trying to do so much, you know, there's obviously a lot of competitors who are going to be innovating, and probably conventionally people might say, well, why don't you just focus on one aspect of this payment process instead of trying to build the entire system? What is your response to that?
Well, we do see it as a focus, but we see it as a different focus. Going back to the Golden Gate Bridge, if we want to build something truly magical, we have to build that entire span, right? It has to be end-to-end. So a lot of our competitors are building a credit card terminal or a point of sale or a cash register or a payment network or a bank. Or coupons, whatnot. And they're all disconnected. They're all separate companies and they're all separate systems. And when you try to, when a merchant or a buyer, a customer tries to put all these together, they don't really fit together. They're not seamless. And you start noticing the seam points. So our focus is building that entire span. Mm-hmm. And there's still a simplicity around that.
Might you be a tender type one day and replace a MasterCard or a Visa?
Well, that's not what we're optimizing for. There's certainly a potential or a reality for that. But our idea has always been we're always going to accept the payment device, the tender that comes over the counter, because that means the merchant is always getting the sale.
So going from, you know, these financial complexities to your mom, does she use Square?
She does. Just yesterday, I sent my mom a gift card from here in New York to her favorite bookstore, Left Bank Books, in the Central West End. And I sent my father a week of cappuccinos to his favorite coffee company, Sump Coffee, in the city.
And I've heard that you text or maybe tweet with your mom daily. What was the last mundane communication you had with her?
No, my mom is usually the first person that texts me in the morning, the last person that texts me every day. They just moved to a new condo that's right on the Mississippi River, so she usually sends me pictures of the sunrise or the sunset.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Jack Dorsey. Coming up, we'll meet Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment, including iPhones, BlackBerries, iPads, and recent Apple computers, among other items. The company was launched in 2006 and has recycled more than 1 million devices since inception. Prior to starting Gazelle, Israel worked as a research analyst at Goldman Sachs and a finance director at eBay and PayPal. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
Could you please describe how Gazelle works? Let's say I have a BlackBerry Curve that I want to get off my hands.
What you'll do is go to our website, either on the desktop or on your mobile device, and look up the specific model that you want to sell. You'll answer a couple of simple questions about the condition of the item, and you get a price. And if you like the price, you'll give us your shipping address so we can send you packaging, and we'll pay for the shipping. As soon as you put the item in the mailbox and ship it to us, we'll receive it, inspect it, make sure that it's as described by you, and then send you the payment.
Now, you're a consumer-facing business, but it hasn't always worked this way. You initially tried partnering with businesses when you first launched. Can you describe that experience and some examples of that?
We've gone through quite an evolution. So in the early days, what we wanted to do is access consumers that buy product, and what a better place than go to Best Buy, go to Radio Shack, go to Amazon, eBay, where consumers buy a new product, and help those companies, those retailers, offer a trading service to their customer base. It just made a lot of sense. What the struggle was back then was that the economy was flourishing, the whole sustainability movement was just getting started, and frankly, this was not top on anybody's list.
And was there a catalyst or a specific event that really gave you the engine and the motivation to say, okay, we're going to change direction?
Yes, it's quite memorable. So we spent a lot of time with Best Buy. In April of 2007, we got a call in the evening basically saying that while they appreciate all the work that we've put into developing the program with them, they were going to pass. We were running out of cash. And again, we either had to close shop or change direction in a very aggressive way.
You also changed course at an auspicious moment. The economy was collapsing, which ironically was beneficial for the company. How come?
It was very beneficial to Gazelle because the biggest opportunity was to build awareness that all the stuff that's in your drawers, in your closets, that you know, the 5-year-old BlackBerry, the 3-year-old laptop that you're not using anymore has a value. It's collecting dust. So in the early days, it was really all about cash for your gadgets that you're not using, as opposed to where it is today, much more on upgrading.
The number of devices that you accept is roughly less than 500. But back then, it was over, 200,000?
It was hundreds of thousands,
including movies and
games and GPS systems, was everything under the sun except for TVs.
And what percent of these devices do actually are you able to resell versus that you're stuck with?
Everything has value. The only question is how much. From day one, everything that we acquired and paid value for, we are able to turn around and sell at the profit. So currently we resell 100% of the product, or if it's not 100%, it's 98%, 99%. The interesting thing about this business, which has always fascinated me, is that it's a supply-constrained business. Demand is insatiable.
You have spoken about the car trade-in business as an analogy to what you're doing. What parallels or similarities do you see, and what would you like to replicate?
Sure. So in the car business, 40 to 50% of all new car sales have a trade-in involved in it. So it's so consumer behavior around trade-in, to your point, is inherent in the way we buy new cars. That figure for consumer electronics is about 3%. Inertia is a very strong kind of human behavior, consumer behavior. When you buy the new, let's say, iPhone, you don't care a whole lot about the old device. It's sort of your ex at the time. So building awareness for the value of the devices and then convincing consumers that there is a service out there in Gazelle that provides a much easier, much more convenient, much faster, much much safer way to get that value for your device is a challenge, a marketing challenge for us.
So when you buy these devices, whom are you selling the used devices to?
I would say it falls into three different categories. The biggest market is in the emerging countries, Southeast Asia. It goes into the Philippines, into Malaysia. The Middle East is a big market, Nigeria. A second category of buyers are insurance companies. When you lose your phone, you drop it in the water, well, you're not getting a new one. The third would be consumers that don't get the warranty or consumers that want to buy a used laptop, a used iPad for their kids maybe.
They'll go to
eBay, they'll go to Amazon, they'll go to our store. Mm-hmm. On those marketplaces and buy directly from us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. Personal circumstances caused you to move back to Boston in 2006. You at the time had been living in the San Francisco area, but your wife wanted to move back to her hometown in Boston. Can you describe that moment?
It was obviously a very important moment in our relationship. And we had an 18-month-old, we had an 8-week-old, two girls. And, you know, both I and my wife, both of us grew up with lots of family around us. And my family was in Israel at the time. And we tried once to fly to Israel from the Bay Area. And it was a complete disaster with the baby crying for 10 straight hours on the flight. And it was time to pack up, move to Boston and be close to family. And figure out the career stuff later.
Right. You mentioned that your family was in Israel. You actually were born in Peru and spent the first 5 or 6 months of your life in Peru. What brought your parents to Peru initially?
So my dad spent 25 years with the Israeli army. He specialized in training of tanks. I guess at the time, in 1970, the Israeli army was in the process of selling tanks to the Peruvian army. I was born there. And they spent about a year there before moving back to Israel.
Were your parents in Israel when the country was founded after World War II?
Both of them were. My dad was born in Bulgaria, so he moved to Israel 3 years before the country was founded. My mom actually was born in Jerusalem under the British mandate.
You spent the first 18 years of your life roughly in Israel. What was the reason for moving to the United States?
Yes, so my my parents in the late 80s, it was actually pretty tough times in Israel in terms of a very prolonged recession. Nobody in my family has ever been to college at the time, and they just felt that education and just giving us an opportunity was their life mission. And I guess they said it's now or never. And just got on the plane and moved here with absolutely no prospects for a job.
So you get off the plane, and what next?
What next? So first, you're intimidated by moving to New York. It was really scary, actually, in the early days. My father scrambling to find a job, my mom looking for a job, I was looking for a job, and it was really all about survival.
What were some of the early jobs you got?
It was for a video store. It was 77th Street and Lexington Avenue, okay. Video Vogue, no longer there. And they were selling consumer electronics in the front. I grew up just loving watching movies. So the idea of working at a store, even was at $4 an hour, bringing movies home and watching them for free, was very appealing to me. I started working there and really didn't have a plan for where to take it.
What else about, just in addition to building a work ethic and having to scramble, how else did working in the video store influence you? I mean, there were electronics in the front of the store. Was there any resonance there?
Well, basically, the purpose of the store was to serve the clientele of the Upper East Side and provide the highest possible customer service known to mankind.
Okay.
So some of the customers were Woody Allen, Robin Williams, Ron Perlman, and they were just very demanding customers. So it was all about doing whatever it takes. But frankly, for me, it was a shock to the system. My first images were not kind of happy memories of watching movies. Was my first winter in New York, delivering movies on my feet while it was snowing and blizzards on the streets, going 10, 20 blocks on Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, delivering movies to those glamorous apartments, mansions in Manhattan. Just my jaw was dropping every time I was dropping off a movie in some of those places. That was cleaning the toilet, frankly, and cleaning the shelves and making sure the store looked good and that it was welcoming to our customers. Those were their early days at Video Vogue.
So moving from Video Vogue to NYU, where you finally went to college and got a degree, what were your ambitions professionally? Were you just trying to make ends meet, or did you have some longer-term plan?
So living in New York, it was kind of natural to gravitate to the finance world. I don't remember the name of the book, but I remember a book that was written about the life of Ron Perlman. It was coincidentally a weekend day that he stopped by.
Ron Perlman being the
Revlon guy, the corporate raider of the 1980s. Which started to get me thinking about Wall Street. The movie Wall Street obviously came out in 1987. And I feel that that's something that I could actually pursue.
What were your parents doing, incidentally? What kind of jobs did they hold?
So my dad was a limo driver, a car service driver. And my mom worked at one of the Israeli newspapers.
After you graduated from NYU, your first job outside of college was at Harvard Business School writing cases for them. And one of the cases you happened to help write was about Microsoft, where you went out to Seattle and you wrote about Bill Gates. Can you describe any interesting tidbits from that experience?
Yeah, that experience clearly planted a seed in me about the future of technology. And one of the things that Bill Gates said at the office, we spent about 3 hours with him. One thing that he said that I'll never forget was that Israel, one of the best ways to change the world is through technology, which has become evident over the years, obviously, with the companies like Microsoft and others. But for me personally, coming from my business background, my finance background, I frankly didn't know who Bill Gates was. I was barely using email at the time, let alone Windows. So that was a whole new world to me. Now, at the time, I didn't know what to do with it. Other than the fact that it was intriguing and interesting, I still had that Wall Street bug in me, so I had to go back and get it out of my system.
So you ultimately went to Goldman Sachs and graduated from HBS and got the Wall Street bug out of you. And then you begin a whole new chapter professionally, which is really in startups and e-commerce. even though you were an employee at these companies, you still had this entrepreneurial itch because in 1997, actually while you were still at Goldman Sachs, you co-authored a business plan for a startup called Cosmo.com, which at the time was an internet-based video rental business,
right,
which at one point had a billion-dollar valuation in 99.
Yes, they actually filed the S-1 in March of 2000, and they were ready to go public.
How did you come to be on the founding team of Cosmo?
So one of my cubemates at Goldman was the co-founder of Cosmo, and he came up with the notion of the idea behind Cosmo right after the Amazon IPO. He approached me because he knew about my experience working at Video Vogue, and we worked together for about 6 months, nights and weekends, developing the business plan, coming up with the name, and at the end of the day, he decided to leave Goldman and pursue it full-time and build Cosmo. I decided to go back to business school.
Were there any impressions from that experience that you've carried with you?
That the world was going to change. It was pretty clear that the world was about to change and the internet was going to revolutionize everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. Prior to starting Gazelle, Israel worked as a research analyst at Goldman Sachs and a finance director at eBay and PayPal. What were some important impressions from eBay or your PayPal experience that have carried over to Gazelle?
What was amazing about that time is to spend 2 years with entrepreneurs in those markets, building their companies from scratch, learning about their challenges of building a business, how they think about an exit strategy, whether eBay was going to buy them, an IPO, a different kind of partnership. So I just soaked up all that knowledge. That was really helpful for me to get a glimpse of what it's like to be an entrepreneur in all those different markets.
I want to go back to the early days of Gazelle for a moment. I want to talk about venture capital. In 2008, even though you had this auspicious moment where the economy was collapsing and people wanted to, you know, resell their items, the economy was collapsing. So their, you know, venture capitalists did not have their checkbooks open. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, first thing I'll say, it was never easy to raise capital, in my experience at Gazelle. But the context of when you raise money, obviously, is critical. And you're raising a good point. So in late 2008, we were raising our second round of capital. So the first round was completed in 2007. Venrock, who incidentally was one of the early investors in Apple, was the lead investor of the Series A. Now, in November of 2008, we were ready to close the B round with Rockport Capital. And I'll never forget the day when we were going to close the deal. That was one of the days that the Dow was fell 1,000 points. And I was really nervous about, is this deal going to close? And I remember at the time, even the Rockport guys, I mean, they still wanted to pursue it, but everybody was getting cold feet. That was the week after the, I don't know if you remember, the Sequoia presentation came out about how the world was going to come to an end and investments were going to shut down and companies had to scale back their growth ambitions. And here we are, pitching a story about growth and about how this is the, you know, the recession and this dynamics in the market was one of the best things that ever happened to Gazelle. So it helped us push the deal through and get it done. But was it easy? Absolutely not.
You co-founded Gazelle with Rousseau Aurelien and James Michelini. Even before you came on board, Rousseau and James were seriously flirting with this concept, and they had borrowed $60,000 to buy used equipment that they then repurposed and sold on eBay for $500,000. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, yeah, so that was fascinating for me when I met with Rousseau, and he was telling me that story in terms of the success they were having, and his point was, everything sells a good profit. The only challenge that we have is getting more equipment. And that was kind of the foundation for the idea for Gazelle and Recommerce. At the time, the whole consumer electronics business on eBay was a $14 billion business. There was just a lot of demand.
So it was Rousseau who had the initial idea for this Recommerce recycling business.
Yeah, what I love the most about Rousseau is such an amazing guy. He's the true visionary guy. I'm more the guy with 2 feet on the ground, getting stuff done. He was really the visionary guy. What really sold me on joining him and James was his grand vision. And his grand vision was to introduce the concept of trade-ins into other consumer categories, starting with electronics, but also sporting goods, golf clubs, fashion items, IT equipment, servers, etc. So the vision was big. Now, pretty quickly after joining the team and we started actually thinking about developing a plan, we had to start somewhere in a narrow focus.
Now, Rousseau is from Haiti.
Yes. And we kind of went together through the earthquake in Haiti, where his parents' house was completely demolished by the earthquake, and they moved to the U.S. and kind of seeing him going through that period, you know, tough period in his life, his family's life, was interesting and, you know, something I could definitely empathize with.
Simultaneously, while Rousseau and James were pursuing this concept on the East Coast, while you were still back west, you wanted to recycle your own mobile equipment. What was that story?
The story was before I was moved back here, it's before I knew about Rousseau, I went down to a retail store and tried to recycle a couple of BlackBerry phones. And I go in and I ask the guy how much for these phones. And the guy goes, $20. Said, $20, I can sell them on eBay for $75. And he goes, no, actually, we're going to charge you $20 for the privilege of recycling. And that was when I had this big aha moment. The consumers are not going to pay for the privilege of recycling. And that's how, you know, the idea of recommerce kind of started to germinate in my head.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
My guest has been Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.